Hello and welcome to Energy Oracles. My name is Simon Ferry. I'm an editor at Petroleum Economist. I'm joined here today by David Fife, chief economist and price reporting agency Argus. So the oil and gas markets have seen considerable flux and disruption in recent years, and that looks likely set to continue, especially now against a backdrop of conflict, sanctions, economic headwinds, and significant shifts in energy supply and flows. So the outlook for the remainder of 2024 remains uncertain, to say the least. So David, if I could turn to you, there's a significant divergence between OPEC and IEA demand outlooks for the next couple of years. Why is that, and what is creating that demand uncertainty?
Well, hi, Simon. Thanks very much for having me on the show. You're absolutely right. You have the two extremes of expectations for oil demand growth this year with the IEA. The lower end of the range, 1.2 million barrels a day or so. OPEC, probably at least a million barrels per day higher than that. We come somewhere between the two at Argus. Our Argus consulting projections are around 1.4 million barrels per day. So we're a little bit higher than the IEA and considerably lower than OPEC. I mean, our view essentially is that there's two reasons why demand growth is going to be significantly slower than last year. One is the sort of slowdown in growth caused by central bank interest rate hikes that is feeding through in Europe, and we think even the US, although the US has been very resilient. And the second point is we just don't see the, you know, 1.5 million barrel per day of growth out of China that we saw last year, which was very largely in response to the reopening and the dismantling of the net zero policy. So we struggle to see how you can get 2 million barrels per day plus with a weakening macro situation and a growth from China last year that we think was a bit of a one-off, even although we think Chinese demand growth continues in certain sectors this year. It's just not going to be as all-pervasive as it was last year.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's see. So, you know, do you think OPEC will maintain its production cuts going forward? And how long do you think Saudi Arabia will be happy to continue to shoulder the bulk of that burden?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've had the rollover of the voluntary segment of the cuts through to the end of June. I think that's baked into the market already. And that's why there was a really very little market response when the announcement came out a few days ago. So everyone was really expecting that, I think. We think there's maybe room for a nudge higher in OPEC production if we leave aside the sort of, you know, Russia and fellow travelers part of the OPEC Plus equation for the time being. We think, you know, there's probably room for 800 to a million barrels a day nudge higher in, you know, core OPEC production between now and the end of the year, but not much more. So that means that, you know, any relaxation of the voluntary part of the cuts, the 2.2 million barrels a day, we think they can only partially relax those by the end of the year. And the bottom line is that's because non-OPEC supply growth is running pretty hot at the moment, even although spending has been curbed to a certain extent. We've got a backlog of projects that were delayed around pandemic time that are coming to fruition now, indeed running through into 2025. And so OPEC Plus collectively are going to have to exercise a high degree of cohesion, not only this year, we think potentially next year as well. And you raise just exactly the right point. If Russia continues to churn out as it has been doing and nibbling away at core Middle Eastern market share in India and China, does Saudi Arabia at some stage say, well, no, we don't like this, we're going to start heavily discounting, or we're going to push out more barrels onto the market? I mean, I suspect they won't. I suspect they will. The Saudis will continue to fire a shot across the bows of other producers via their OSPs into Asia and that sort of thing, and keep them relatively low to try and keep Saudi crude competitive. I don't think they want all-out war, if I can put that in parentheses, in terms of market share, and they'll avoid flooding the market. But I think there'll be some pretty intense negotiations, virtual or otherwise, between now and June.
Ah, thanks for that, David. And how will the expected growth of non-OPEC production, US, China, Canada in particular, impact the market this year? Is the influence of OPEC Plus poised to wane, you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we essentially have, you know, we've got about 1.4, 1.5 million barrels a day of global demand growth this year, and we think that gets gobbled up by non-OPEC supply entirely. And it's Guyana and it's Brazil. There's a bit from Canada. There's a dribs and drabs from the North Sea. And there's, you know, maybe sort of 400,000 barrels a day of growth from the US, a lot slower than last year. We had, you know, a million plus from the US last year. And we do think consolidation and financial discipline are now embedded in the US shale space. So it's going to grow more slowly than it did at the tail end of last decade when we were getting a million BD plus from shale on an annual basis. It's going to be much, much slower than that, 40 or 50% of that, we think, on a trend basis. But it's still going to grow. There's still the resource there. There are productivity gains. So we still see US incremental barrels, light sweet barrels overwhelmingly, coming onto the market from that source of supply. So, you know, there's a bunching of incremental oil from non-OPEC. We think this year and next year, 1.5 million barrels a day. And really that accounts for most of the demand growth. And that's why OPEC Plus are going to be a little bit under the cosh.
So are US shale producers still potentially vulnerable to increased Saudi and Gulf output, you think?
Well, I think it works both ways. We're going to have less growth, probably less rapid growth, you know. So there was a lot of talk 2 or 3 years ago about US shale being the new swing supplier, and it's not. It's not low cost, and it's not incredibly short lead time. I mean, yes, it's shorter lead time than deep water or Arctic production, but it still needs an awful lot of infrastructure build out and an awful lot of investment. So I think the idea of US supply as the sort of shorter cycle, but it's not a super short cycle. And I think you're right. So, you know, the upside may be less rapid, and it may be less responsive to fluctuations in price going forward. You have, you know, larger corporations now controlling a lot of the acreage, and they're probably going to be a lot less responsive to fluctuations in price, both on the upside and probably on the downside. So it's likely to be a rather more stable source of supply than it was, let's say, in its first decade. You know, if you take 2010 to up until the pandemic, you know, that was the sort of Klondike phase where it was volume at all costs, almost literally at all costs. And I suspect that phase is behind us now. And in a sense, it's not at all surprising. It's like any industry, any nascent industry that starts up. You get a huge flush of investment, hundreds of participants, and very rapid growth. And then as an industry matures, you get fewer participants and a more measured pace of growth. And that's exactly what we're seeing, going to see from the US shale space.
Ah, thanks for that. That's interesting. And if we can move on to that question of sanctions there, I mean, what's your view of the G7's price cap on Russian crude? Did that fail, or did it succeed, you know, in limiting revenues somewhat without causing the market to spike?
Well, I mean, the price cap theoretically at least applies to FOB prices at the port of loading. Of course, an awful lot of Russian crude is now moving at delivered prices, be that into India or into China. There were two key objectives of the price cap. One was to ensure the continued flow of Russian crude and products to global markets. And that part of the policy has been overwhelmingly successful. In the first half of last year, the Russian revenue flow was substantially down year on year, so versus 2022, partly because just the oil complex was weaker, but also because Urals, for example, was selling at a sort of $40 discount in the early part of last year to North Sea Dated. Now, as that differential has narrowed and revenues have actually picked up, and really essentially, with one or two exceptions over the last 6 months, you know, Russian revenue flows are running above year-ago levels. And so, not surprisingly, we've seen the G7 and the US and the UK beginning to tighten the screw on shipping and, you know, trying to sound out companies who have demonstrably been carrying cargoes that have been transacted at prices above the price cap. The question is, how far will the US go and its allies go in what is essentially an election year? If this were not an election year and the Biden administration felt it had wiggle room to swallow hard and absorb $100 oil, then they might go after Russian cargoes rather more aggressively. But it's rather difficult with a tight race anticipated in November and the specter of $4.55 a gallon gasoline not all that far behind us in the rearview mirror from 2022. I think they want to avoid that at all costs. So yes, they will try and tighten sanctions, but I don't think they're going to go the whole hog and really chase Russian cargoes off the market, because that politically could be, indirectly politically, could be quite damaging closer to home for European elections, US elections, and so on.
You know, we've seen recent attacks by Ukrainian forces on Russian refineries. Do you see this potentially resulting in Russia exporting more crude, with given the damage to refining capacity?
Yeah, I mean, so far, I certainly wouldn't characterize, for example, the attack on Ust-Luga as a minor attack. But nonetheless, these are things that have been repairable within the space of a couple of months or so. The question is Ukraine either minded or capable of launching more extensive attacks on Russian energy infrastructure? Now, there's one question, which is, have they actually been holding back in terms of drone attacks because of a tacit agreement with their allies in the West not to target, you know, exports of Russian petroleum? That is really an open question. I'm not sure of the answer to that. And the second question is, do they actually have the hardware with which to cause more of a spectacular disruption, if you like? I suspect it will persist probably at this sort of pinprick, and I'm not sort of downplaying the seriousness of an explosion at a refinery, but I would suspect it will continue at this sort of level. And what that means is that probably, you know, there's going to be a squeeze probably on diesel supplies, diesel exports out of Russia, which have been heading elsewhere outside of Europe. But with the diesel complex already in Europe incredibly tight and scrabbling around for supplies because of the attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, any further squeeze on global diesel supply because of Russian refineries being targeted obviously risks a spike in diesel prices feeding its way back into the particularly tight European market.
Ah, that's some interesting points there. And obviously India has played a big role in absorbing those Ural barrels that have been diverted away from Europe as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So, I mean, does that demonstrate the burgeoning importance of the Indian market in global energy demand?
I think that is certainly happening. I mean, if we look at the GDP numbers coming out of India for the tail end of 2023, very, very strong, and expectations of, you know, 6-7% GDP growth this year, outstripping almost by a factor of two what we expect from China this year. Obviously, it's got a much, much smaller industrial base. Some would say an underdeveloped industrial base. But yeah, over time, not imminently, but you know, over a sort of 5 to 10 year period, we would see India and Southeast Asia beginning to grab the baton from China in terms of oil demand growth. Initially, in sort of aggregate terms, if you take India and Southeast Asia together, and then gradually, probably, you know, by the end of the decade and into the early parts of next decade, India is going to be a much larger importer of crude, and probably there'll be a dent in some of their refined products exports as domestic demand begins to pick up as well.
So we talked there about the sanctions on Russia, but of course Iran and Venezuela are also major sanction producers. What do you see their role in the market, and do you think the US will impose renewed sanctions on Caracas this year?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, both sides probably have an interest in a warming of that relationship with, you know, Russian crude essentially out of the Atlantic Basin. U.S. refineries are very fond of Venezuelan crude for quality-related reasons. So, the ability to take more Venezuelan oil, and indeed that applies elsewhere within the Atlantic Basin. There's been a shortage, a tightness in, you know, medium and heavier sour crude availability. So anything that frees up the availability of more Venezuelan barrels would probably be welcomed within the Atlantic Basin. The problem, as often is the case, is a political one, and I think I'm right in saying we have an election due probably in the middle of the year now in Venezuela. I think I read that earlier today. And the question is, you know, are opposition candidates allowed to run in that race? Very difficult to see the incumbent regime in Caracas being terribly welcoming of that potential. But if they don't, then obviously the threat is that the US reimposes sanctions that will choke off any expansion in the Venezuelan upstream sector. What I would say is, let's face it, that the incremental barrels we're going to get out of Venezuela are fairly small change in the global scheme of things, because that is an oil sector that has just been destroyed over the last 20 years, starved of investment, operating under sanctions. The exit of many, many Western companies, not only upstream companies, but service companies. So, you know, it's most unlikely you'd see the sort of uptick of up to 1 million barrels a day that we've seen in Iranian supply, for example. That just isn't feasible from Venezuela in the short to medium term. Could be over the longer term, but not in the short term.
Has Iran lost market share to Russian barrels?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as we mentioned earlier on, there are question marks over, you know, how much crude demand into China is going to grow this year. I mean, it grew by a whopping, I think, 1.6 million barrels a day last year. We don't think we're going to see the same level of growth this year. And so we may have sort of hit a high water mark in terms of how much Iranian crude can go in there. What Iranian crude had going for it was that it was pretty heavily discounted for obvious reasons. You know, as sanctioned barrels, the discounts were very high. The Chinese refiner is nothing if not a seeker of a good bargain. And so it will really depend on the relative attractiveness of the pricing of Russian barrels and Iranian barrels. But I wouldn't expect significant incremental growth from either of those sources over the first 6 months of this year. But they'll be battling it out for market share together with the Saudis.
Interesting. So obviously there's a lot of topics that we could get into, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the Red Sea attacks. You know, they've caused obviously significant freight market disruption, but appear to have little impact on energy prices, be they crude or LNG. Why is that, David?
A very good point. I mean, I think there's been a fairly clear distinction between a westbound refined products trade, which has fallen off quite sharply and is essentially going around the Cape of Good Hope, container ships doing very much the same thing. But, you know, there seems to be a fair amount of crude coming out of either the Baltic or the Black Sea that has been passing through the Red Sea relatively unscathed by some of these attacks. Now, is that because of, you know, political affiliations and so on, you know, and all the rest of it? I mean, I leave your listeners to decide who exactly the Houthis may be targeting. But it's certainly been the case that crude vessels are moving in a rather more unconstrained fashion than refined products, you know. And we think that's probably where the pinch point is going to remain, much more in terms of refined products freight, which of course is crucial, for example, for the European market, with product coming in either from the US or from the Middle East or India. And certainly the latter cargoes are having to take the 2 to 3 week longer route and a much more expensive route coming around the Cape and north into the Atlantic Basin.
Yeah, a lot of very interesting points there, David. Well, look, I think that wraps up our chat for today. Thanks again for joining us, David. And thanks again to everyone listening to this episode of Energy Oracles.
Thank you, Simon.